are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a monthly program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we will be talking to Dr. John Marsliff, the James Ridgway Professor of Wildlife Sciences at our own University of Washington. He has written 4 books and over 100 scientific papers on bird behavior and wildlife. During the program, we will be reviewing his recent books, In the Company of Crows and Ravens, Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. I can't wait to talk about that. And Welcome to Suburbia, sharing our neighborhoods with wrens, robins, woodpeckers, and other wildlife. Welcome, John. I'm so happy to have you here today.
My pleasure, Chris. Great to be here.
I'd like to start out with a childhood memory that you wrote about in Suburbia. And can you tell us about how you got started on this quest to find out what happens in an area of urban development?
Sure thing. Yeah, it was very powerful for me to grow up as a kid on kind of a light suburban area on the edge of farmland in Kansas. And I remember one day seeing a bunch of new flags that had occurred in this field of soybeans and forest edge that we would spend our days in as kids. And that meant that there was going to be a new development there. And I remember asking my dad what would happen, you know, when this vegetation is all gone and there's new houses here, what's going to happen to the deer and things like that. I was especially interested in mammals at that time. And he said, well, don't worry, it'll be okay. They'll find another place. And, you know, I'm sure we both realize that wasn't completely true, but with my work that we've done with birds here in the Seattle area, we can actually start addressing that question and understand how do birds respond when their habitat goes from a nice forest one day, literally in a few days, to a parking lot or to a cleared space or to somebody's backyard. What happens to those birds that were there was a question that motivated me as a kid, and I'm happy to be able to get back to now.
Well, as a person that moved to Port Townsend 10 years ago and made one of those clearings in the forest, I'd like to know who stays and who goes. I have my own ideas based on what's happened in my yard, but I'd like to hear what research says.
Sure. It's convenient for us to kind of talk about a couple or three groups of birds and how they respond to that sort of activity. So the first group we call avoiders. And as you might guess, when you put that clearing in, those animals leave the area. And so around here, that would be something like a black-throated gray warbler or even a hairy woodpecker. Their numbers drop as these animals avoid human activity, and the requirements that they have, the understory or the dead trees that these animals require, as it's removed, their numbers decline dramatically. Then there's another group of birds that really adapts to that change. We call them adapters. They basically are able to weather the change that occurs there. And one of the most common species here that adapts is the song sparrow. Another one might be something like the American goldfinch, our state bird. And as we clear areas and allow the shrubby second growth to occur and even the planted manicured lawns and gardens that we maintain and bird feeders that we put out, they really play right into those birds' hands. They provide the food that they're looking for anyway, and they provide the sort of setting that those birds require. So they increase in response to our clearing of land and settlement of a forest. And then there's another group called the exploiters, and these are the guys that really take advantage of us. They're the crows that we're so familiar with in our area here. They come in and rely upon the subsidies we provide in these new environments, and they thrive and increase in abundance as we develop a forested setting.
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, we're pretty familiar with the famous or infamous efforts to save the spotted owl a couple of decades ago now. But then a larger and more aggressive owl appeared. He's in my neighborhood, and I like listening to him. I wish I had great horned like you. But can you tell us about what happened? What happened with the spotted owl, and who is this more aggressive guy?
It's a classic example of two of the kinds of species we just mentioned. So the spotted owl is a extreme avoider of human activity. Not that it doesn't like people and doesn't tolerate our presence. I mean, you can hike right under a spotted owl, as I've done, and they'll look at you and basically ignore your presence. They don't have a problem with us per se, but they require deep forested environments, big forested environments, where the prey that they utilize, flying squirrels or red tree voles, occurs. And those settings basically are old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. And of course, as we've removed those, the spotted owl has declined in its abundance until it was listed as an endangered species. As we've settled our areas, and especially even something beyond the Northwest, as the Great Plains were increasingly forested with hedgerows and trees planted around people's farms in the Midwest and southern Canada, the owls and other species from the East Coast have been able to move through that now more forested midsection of the continent and get over to the West Coast. So the barred owl is one species that effectively did that. And that was a result of fire suppression on the prairies, removing bison from the prairies, and planting around farms. And so barred owls made their way west, and they hit the West Coast up in British Columbia, and they basically have wiped out spotted owls in British Columbia, and they've moved down through Washington into Oregon and California, and they're in the process of wiping out spotted owls here as well. Bigger, a little more aggressive.
When you say wiping out, do you mean that they actually use the spotted owl as prey, or do they just chase them away?
There's a variety of things that have occurred as the barred owl has moved in. First, they started interbreeding with spotted owls because barred owls were rare, and spotted owls and barred owls are closely related, and that was the closest available mate, and a lot of barred owls interbred with spotted owls. That doesn't happen so much. Occasionally, they do kill them, but mostly they just outcompete them and behaviorally exclude them from an area. They come in and they chase them out of their territories. They don't tolerate them in the same space. And as barred owls fill the space, there's nothing left for spotted owls.
Thanks for explaining that to me. Recently, in the Washington Post, some of us have read about the sage grouse. And the decision not to list the sage grouse as endangered, it has been called a lifesaver by some and a death knell by others. Can you comment on this recent news about the sage grouse?
Yeah, I've kind of played those multiple interpretations back and forth in my head as I've tried to understand this decision as well. If you look at what happened when the spotted owl was listed, timber harvest on federal lands basically was shut down, completely stopped. And that built a huge animosity against the owl. And there were, you know, famous situations on the Olympic Peninsula where spotted owls were nailed to the Welcome to Forks, Washington sign. That kind of animosity has led conservationists and especially conservation policy making to take into account a little more how people are going to react to these decisions. And I think that's what happened with the sage grouse here. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the sage grouse has declined. It will continue to decline as we increasingly use shrublands in the western United States for oil, gas, and agricultural purposes. There's no doubt that this species is biologically threatened by this loss of habitat. So from the straight biological standpoint, yeah, we should list it and conserve those areas. But the potential detriment of that is that people will view this animal as the enemy and do everything they can to basically shoot shovel and shut up with respect to their interaction with this this grouse. And it could have a negative influence on its abundance, and certainly on our perception of how much we have to sacrifice as a human species for other species like the grouse. It might eventually lead to the continual degradation of the Endangered Species Act as something that people just aren't willing to tolerate anymore, the sacrifices that have to be made for that act. So I think all those decisions go into, do you list or not list this species? Biologically, yeah, you should list it. Politically, probably you should not list it to engender more and more support for the animal. And I think what tipped the balance in favor of not listing was that there are a lot of cooperative agreements in place with private landowners, because this species lives a lot on private land. And if private landowners don't want to conserve a species, it's pretty easy for them not to.
Okay.
But if they are incentivized to conserve them by not having the species listed and by entering these cooperative agreements where they get benefits by having the species there, then it makes sense not to list the species at this time.
Okay, that's the good news. Let's hope it plays out that in that way. So let's make our conversation more local. We all want to see more pileated woodpeckers, if not in our backyards, then along our trails. And we want to see our annas hummingbirds stay all year round. So what can we do? I'd like you to talk about feeders. Are they helpful or harmful? I'd like you to talk about what we can do for our habitat and improve the safety for our birds here in Port Townsend.
For sure. And I think really we're in a really lucky place in the United States to do these sorts of things. Trees grow easily here. It's not a struggle to create habitat if you're willing and wanting to do that. Certainly, with respect to the pileated woodpecker and other woodpeckers, which are important facilitators of the presence of other species in our environment, the chickadees and bluebirds that we also like, absolutely require woodpeckers to be around to create nest sites for them. And the key ingredient there is dead trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to appreciate and cultivate dead trees in our living space. And we think of them as dangerous. They're called hazard trees, you know, a lot. But really, they're incredible biological resources that are important for woodpeckers in particular. So some things you can do, one, if you have a dead tree or a dead branch in a tree, is to preserve that. You know, be safe about it. Make sure that it's not posing a potential hazard to life or property. But for the most part, it's just a matter of leaving it there and letting it, you know, rot in place. And that provides habitat for these woodpeckers. You might also even create a snag on your property. I've made tens of them on my property now, and we've done things like kill the entire tree through logging activities, or just the top part of the tree. Girdling the top 20 feet or so of a large Douglas fir allows the tree to live. It reduces the hazard of the tree by taking out some of the sail that catches the wind, and it provides that upper part of the tree as a dead resource for woodpeckers. And I was looking at one in my yard yesterday. I came home from a trip and noticed that there had been a tremendous amount of bark removed by the pileated woodpecker in my yard. And it just doesn't take long, and it doesn't take a lot of effort to allow this resource to really develop around our properties.
I am so happy you said that, because I did create a snag on the edge of my property, and that's where I saw my first pileated woodpecker.
Fantastic.
It was in the springtime. It didn't stay for the summer, but a lot of people questioned that we did this. But thank you for talking about creating a snag. So that's great.
Thank you for doing it.
That's great. So what about the feeders? There's a lot of controversy about creating the little chestnut-backed chickadee attics by feeding them all year round. What do you think about year-round feeding?
Well, the research that's been done really suggests that year-round feeding is good and fine to do. Under maybe a couple of caveats I'll come back to at the end, but what feeding does is it builds populations of those adaptive and exploitive species. So those are the species that do well with us, and the reason they do well with us is that they're able to evolve in response to our challenges. And building a large population just allows these species to really evolve through natural selection in interacting with us. Small populations, by random chances, a few bad years, for example, they would go extinct. So by feeding, we increase the survivorship of animals that use the feeders. We increase the abundance of them in the area because of that. We increase their fitness as they go into the breeding season, and therefore the number of young they produce that next spring. And all of that feeds into a vibrant population that can adjust to the other challenges we put out there, like some of the pollutants or the changes in climate and things like that that are occurring. So I think it's good to do. It's especially good in North America. It's good in mainland Europe. There are some places in the world, New Zealand in particular, and Australia, where some of the species that are really benefiting by feeding are also extremely aggressive and take over native habitats that are nearby. So that's a problem. But so you should be somewhat aware of the sorts of animals that are utilizing your feeder and what their ecological role is in perhaps reducing the diversity of the animals that are around us. But here in the Pacific Northwest, for sure, we're increasing diversity with these feeders, and we're supporting species that are able to adapt to us. We're not really making addicts either. You can go weeks, you know, without feeding, or even try to stick with a chickadee for a day.
I know.
See what it does. 30 or 40% of its time at your feeder, and the rest of the time it's going to be picking bugs off of your alders and getting natural foods as well.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. This is Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and today we're talking to John Marsliff and about his books Welcome to Suburbia and Gifts of the Crow. So a lot of people are aware of you and your research, John, because they saw A Murder of Crows on PBS's wonderful program Nature. In fact, I think I watched it twice. Can you talk to us, tell us again about that incredible research and experiment using the masks and showing us how really smart crows and ravens are?
Sure. I think the interesting aspect here is that it really shows why crows are able to exploit us like they do. And what we demonstrated was that they recognize individual people, and they recognize how we've treated them. And they use that information to survive better with us, and they pass along that information socially by observational learning to others in the group. So what we did, kind of as a, you know, to solve, something we were curious about, a very minor point early, is that we always felt when we would go up to a nest or catch a crow to band it for our studies, that they recognized and responded to us differently after that. They tend to avoid us or be a little aggressive. So we captured some birds wearing a particular mask. It was a caveman-like mask that we captured our first birds with around our campus here in Seattle. And we then compared the response of those birds when we later wore that mask versus either wearing no mask or wearing a control mask, which was a mask of then Vice President Dick Cheney. And we'd see the response of the crows to us wearing these different faces. And it was quite clear from the very start that they responded very aggressively and strongly if we wore the mask that we had originally captured some birds with versus any other mask or no mask at all.
And then also on another nature program, we watched Betty. And she was, I believe, a New Caledonian crow. Am I correct about that?
That's right, New Caledonian crow.
Right. And I mean, she was able to use a hook, create a hook, to retrieve a basket of food in a fixed tube. What do Corvids have going for them that she was able to plan this success? That was just amazing to me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, both of these talents, one from New Caledonia, where there aren't woodpeckers in their environment, so the crow there saw an open niche, the ability to probe and poke into crevices in the ground or the bark with a tool to get food like a woodpecker might do with its beak and long tongue. And then here in the urban setting around our local American crows that recognize people so well, both of them are able to do these innovative tasks because they have incredibly large brains, they are long-lived, and they live in social groups. And the big brain of a crow, especially the forebrain, that place where those complex associations and planning centers of the brain occur, those are accentuated in crows. And so they've got that going for them. They have the mental capacity. But they also have the kind of opportunity to learn and innovate because they live, you know, for decades. An individual bird could be 20 mm-hmm. or 30 years old and have accumulated lots of knowledge during that time. And also they interact with one another a lot, so they can learn from each other about good and bad things in their environment. So, for example, those American crows that recognize people, they learn bad people or good people just by watching other crows. They don't have to experience the wrath or benefit to learn to make that association.
So do you believe that birds have emotions? Do they really joke around and play?
I absolutely believe they have emotions. The scientific community is pretty solid on that. We know animals play, especially animals that are in relatively relaxed situations, which happens when getting food is fairly easy for them to do. So think about a crow's life again. They have a lot of free time, and in that free time, they can play. And play isn't just a waste of time. Play is an important learning arena, where new connections in the brain are made and new experiences are obtained. New social companions are tested and maintained. So there's a lot going on with play that is rewarding chemically in the brain by feeling good, but also maybe useful later on in a bird's life.
Mm-hmm.
They also clearly have the emotion of fear. When they learn, you know, these dangerous new things in their environment, we've shown with brain imagery technology here at the university that the part of the brain that's activated is the amygdala. And the amygdala is the part of the brain in us, humans, that is also activated when we have emotional responses and predominantly fear responses. So we know birds are activating the same parts in their brain with the same chemical transmitters in response to the same situations that we do, and therefore there's no reason to suspect they aren't feeling that emotional response just like we are.
And what about language? Do they mimic us? Do they imitate us? And what about their own communication?
Their communication is incredibly complex. There have been lots of attempts to kind of unravel the language of the crow or raven, and they've all failed miserably. We've determined, you know, 30 or more calls that mean different things, and we know they're the emotional state of the bird also varies their voice from, you know, a fearful bird in a high-pitched tone versus an aggressive bird in a low-pitched tone of voice, that voices are individually distinct. So there's lots of information about emotion and who and what is being said in their communication. But it's undoubtedly much, much more complex than we know.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that they can imitate human voice absolutely perfectly. A young bird that's raised around a human or even an older bird will build a vocabulary that is comprised of human words. And I've got many stories from people who were raised 30 or 40 years ago when crows were not an uncommon pet, and they were fooled by the crow calling in their mother's voice, "Hey, come back to home, come back to home." And the kid would come running back, "Mom, what's up?" And it wasn't mom, it was the pet crow or raven that was talking. So they can be very effective at at imitating our voice and using it appropriately.
Can you let us in on some of your research techniques and how can we contribute as citizen scientists and observers here on the Olympic Peninsula? What do you do? And what are your graduate
absolutely.
Students
absolutely. That's
do?
A great question, and it's a great opportunity for everyone to contribute to these sorts of things. What we typically do is we typically catch and mark our animals some way so that we can identify them and keep up with their lives. So whether it's a song sparrow in suburbia that we want to know how long it lives, who it mates with, how many young it produces, or a crow that we tag to just see their overall interaction with people. That's kind of the fundamental approach that my lab uses. Mm-hmm. It just makes it easier for us to build a unique history of these animals. But I think something along those lines that people can do, and I'm sure many of your listeners have had this experience, they might find a dead bird that has a band on it. And just reporting that sighting to the National Bird Banding Lab is incredibly important. Or some people have a banded bird that's coming to their feeder and getting a photograph of that and sending it to the Audubon Society or to a university is very helpful. I've got just this year photographs from two people, one in southern Canada, but about 500 miles north of Seattle here, and another one from a more local spot of our banded crows that we had had in captivity, done brain imaging on, then released, and now they've been seen back in their native habitats. And for us to get those kind of sightings have been fantastic. And just by taking a picture of the bird, we could read the band or see the combination of color rings on their legs mm-hmm. that we use to identify the bird. So reporting any sighting of a marked bird is key for anybody.
Okay.
And there have been a lot of birds from our studies and others on the Olympic Peninsula that have marked birds. So that would be really useful. Then the other thing is, I think just because phones with cameras are so prevalent now, we have the unprecedented opportunity to kind of document these rare behaviors. And a good example of this is that crows often will leave gifts for people at where they're getting food. And to get photographs of those things that crows leave, or especially a crow with something unusual, like a jewel or a necklace or a key in their beak that they drop off at a particular location, those photographs would be really important for us to know kind of, are they adults or immatures that do this mm-hmm. sort of activity?
Good to know.
So
good
there's
to
lots
know.
That people can do.
Right. So one last thing, and this is a little bit controversial here in Port Townsend, but can you talk to us about safety and cats?
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up. The two most important sources of mortality, limiting factors for birds, really worldwide, but certainly nationally and certainly locally, are windows and cats. And windows that are big, clear glass spaces, birds don't see as a barrier, and they fly into them. And the typical house would have two or three birds killed per year, and that adds up to a half a billion per year birds killed by windows in the United States every year. So you can make your windows visible with screens or netting on the outside or ultraviolet reflective stickers that you can put on them that don't block our view much at all. So that's an easy thing. Harder thing is the outdoor cat, and there's no question in the scientific community that cats are the number one source of bird mortality. The best estimates for the U.S. put the number of birds killed by free-ranging cats at somewhere between 2 and 4 billion per year. That's 1 in 10 birds per year being killed by cats that are allowed to either live freely outside or their pets that come and go in and out. And even if they don't kill them, they scare birds off of nests and displace their behavior such that they're more vulnerable to other predators as well.
Thank you so much for that warning. And I'm sure we'll be discussing it more and thinking about your cat and how you can keep it away from your bird feeder and and keep it indoors more.
And keep it healthier.
And keep it healthier.
Really, as well. Cats live twice as long inside as outside.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You have been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. Today we talked to Dr. John Marshlove, the author of Suburbia. And there are other authors in the Northwest, Tony Angel, who's written The House of Owls, Paul Banik, The Owl and the Woodpecker, and Leanda Lynn Haupt, Crow Planet, and Urban Bestiary. You can find those books at your bookstore or at your local library. I'd like to leave you with a quote from John, and it is, "Do unto your land and the natural web of life, it sustains, as you would have the land do unto you." Or more simply, love thy wild neighbor. There'll be more books and authors next time. Thanks for joining us.